10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which recently lowered tuition by 30% and guarantees graduation in 4 years to all students who meet certain criteria. Carthage ranks 15th in best value among Midwest regional colleges, according to U.S. News and World Report. More information at carthage.edu. On today's morning show, we probe into one of the central aspects of what it means to be human, our ability to remember, and of the stress and even trauma that can be involved when our capacity to remember begins to be undermined for whatever reason. Catherine Jackson Raymond experienced this in middle age, and it prompted her to study memory and to ultimately write a fascinating book about it called Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails, When Memory Fades in Midlife.
It began in my late 30s. I had been an investigative journalist all my career, and I took a number of years off to raise my two little boys. And when it was time for me to go back to work, something that I had looked forward to, in fact, I found that something had changed. The first thing that I realized was that I'd always been able to take a large pile of research and read through it and understand it, absorb it, be able to synthesize it and come up with something that was conceptually new and interesting, and none of this was happening. I would run my eyes up and down this pile of research, and nothing would stay in. And I could not figure out what that was about. I was all of 39 years old. I knew no one that was having that kind of experience. And it seemed to me that either there was something wrong with my eyes, that was proven to be incorrect after a long stint with the ophthalmologist, or that I had just, quote-unquote, lost my edge, and when or if that would be coming back, I had no idea. It was very discouraging, needless to say. I loved my career. I wanted it back. And it took me several years to figure out that what was going on with me was not just a problem about in terms of understanding and absorbing what I read, but that there were other things. There were words that went missing when I spoke. I couldn't think of a word. There were the titles of books and movies that was a problem. Sometimes I couldn't identify the name of the person standing in front of me. And once again, I was still just in my early 40s, and I really did not recognize that this was going on with other people. Hmm. It took until I was in my mid-40s before I looked around and I said, wait a minute, all these other people are doing these same kinds of things and talking about it to me, in a sort of joking but somewhat disparaging way. I can see that in many cases self-esteem is starting to suffer. And what is it? This is in fact a problem with forgetfulness. This is not a visual problem.
Hmm. I thought it was interesting that for you, as you describe in the book's preface, sort of a last straw where you felt like you just needed to get to the bottom of this came when you and your husband went to a movie, and it's already on the way back that you realize how little you can remember about this movie, which you just saw and just liked. I mean, it wasn't
That's
a
right.
forgettable movie, but I thought that was interesting that it was in a moment like that and not, I mean, drawing a blank on your sister's name or something that, you know, we could imagine something like that being the kind of, oh,
now,
my gosh, I have to do something about it.
I can remember this moment very, very well, I guess, because it was such a breakthrough moment for me, and that I decided at that very second that I would be writing this book and that nobody would be stopping me. But we were coming out of a movie. We'd just gotten in the car and leaving the parking lot of this suburban theater when I had this feeling that someone had drawn an opaque screen down over certain important pieces of information, like what was the name of this movie, who played the leading role. And I sat there in a befuddlement in the car in the dark. My husband was driving, and I thought to myself, I cannot even bring myself to tell my husband that I can't remember the name of the movie, because there seems to be something very, very wrong with that. And at that point, I said, you know, this is running my life, and I'm not going to let this happen. You know, if it's going to run my life, it's not going to be because I didn't put up a fight.
Right.
And I decided to go out and find out what was going on.
Part of what made you, of course, sensitive to this was that you had seen a loss of memory sort of bring someone almost down to their knees.
Mm-hmm. I had seen it more than once. And
yes.
I had a very, as I describe in Carved in Sand, I had a very good friend who had been at the top of her profession in Los Angeles. You know, she just was the one to beat. And between 40 and 50, some very dramatic things happened to her. And one of them was that she became really forgetful. And it was very difficult for her to work in an environment where most people were very young. I mean, this is the case in the movie industry. Your average employee is in her 20s or 30, early 30s. And my friend found that she just wasn't able to keep up, and she had this terrible sense of insecurity all the time about her job. And eventually, as I say in the book, she decided that she couldn't do it anymore, and she left, and she began taking antidepressants, and things really only got worse, in my opinion. Might have become a little easier for her to live with her new situation, but cognitively, it did not improve for her.
And you say that her story suggests at least the possibility that maybe, although often depression is said to cause some memory loss, that this might be a case of exactly the reverse.
Yes.
of serious memory loss, actually the trauma of that loss causing depression, which just exacerbated the original problem.
Yes, I mean, this is actually quite new thinking on this topic. I mean, we've seen doctors diagnose depression over and over again when people come in talking about memory problems. It's always depression as far as they're concerned, and it's always time for antidepressants, which I might add are, you know, can be lifesavers in many situations. But in the case of a very mild ongoing depression, antidepressants also affect cognition in a very negative way. So what you think may be the fogginess of your depression may very well be the fogginess of your antidepressant. But that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about how this gets misinterpreted, and it's kind of a tricky and delicate thing. But when you have relied on your brain your entire life, when it's been your expectation, when you have never even recognized it as something special, this is just who you are, it's how you operate, it's everything you are, and that goes away, well, how are you expected to feel? You're going to be very happy and enthusiastic about the fact that the stuff that you were able to hang on to with no problem for your entire life is now elusive. I think it's a very serious problem for many people, and I don't think I really understood how serious until the book came out and, you know, was sort of widely recognized, and I began to get letters and letters and letters and emails from people telling me about how shattered their self-confidence and self-esteem is, not because they began by being depressed, but because they've lost so much of their ability to think and to recall.
Mm. One woman you interviewed puts it in a way that on the surface seems kind of lighthearted, but one wonders just with what sort of a smile, if a smile at all. She said that once upon a time, mentally, she considered herself an AK-47, and now thinks of herself, when it comes to having to think of something, more like a musket. You've got to load it, tamp it, pack it down, and then fire. And in a world where so much moves so quickly and where we are bombarded with so much, it's hard to imagine someone who is sort of mentally like a musket being able to function very well or very happily.
Well, I will say that particular person who I know very well, Her musket is a heck of a lot faster than most people's AK-47. But for her, it's still much slower than what she's used to. She, you know, she's remarkably bright and extremely efficient. And for her, she feels much, much slower. And it is very difficult for her. It's a challenge.
We're speaking with Catherine Jacobson Raymond. We're talking about her book, Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. So when you decided to get serious about investigating this, first of all, I'm kind of struck by the fact that you really were doing two things at once. You wanted to investigate your own problems with your deteriorating memory, but also very much wanted to cast a wide net and talk to as many people as possible who were experiencing sort of a similar thing. Talk for a moment just about that sort of double-barrel approach to this this question or topic.
Well, I certainly wanted the book to be more than a shall we say, whiny memoir. You know, I didn't want it to be about what had happened to my memory. I wanted to be the guinea pig. I wanted to be the one who stepped out for all people in midlife and said, let's find out what can be done. Let's find out if this is, first of all, let's find out if it's normal. And if it's normal, let's find out if it's acceptable. And if it's not acceptable, let's find out what we can do about it. So I did. I interviewed over 300 midlife individuals for the book. I did this by creating a survey. I was pressed to create the survey because I began my research, like, you know, journalists always do, by talking to basically anyone who would talk to me. And I found that people were just bubbling over with great anecdotes and stories and feelings, and I simply couldn't get it down fast enough because this would happen in the supermarket or, you know, at a event, a social event, and I'd be left with nothing to write on, or, you know, there are times it's very awkward to pull out a pad and start scribbling. So I decided, well, I better figure something out here, and I created this survey, and it was very long. It was 10 pages long. Now, anybody will tell you, no one will answer a 10-page survey of any kind. In fact, no one will answer a survey. So I thought, this thing is going to go, you know, into the computer trash or into the actual trash. But that was not the case at all. I sent it out by email, so by snail mail for those people who didn't want it by email. But it became viral, and people were sending it off to their sister-in-laws and to their kids' teachers and to their friends from college. And it was just unbelievable how this thing caught on like wildfire. So out of the about 800 I sent out, I had over 300 back. And in that group, I chose to tour the United States, as it were, setting up conversation groups in various cities. And I would invite people who had responded, you know, very eloquently to come and chat with other people, which they, to my astonishment, did, because first thing that they required and that I offered with the survey was anonymity, because very few people wish to go public on this subject, even though I think that's changing now. Few people want to, and so when I made the offer of conversation groups, I thought, you know, who's going to want to do this, because then people will know who you are. Well, that was wrong. People came in 10s and 12s and 15s and sat around for 3 hours and ate up all the wine and cheese and talked and talked and talked. And I knew right then, frankly, that I had hit a nerve, that this is something that people had to get out.
Right. I find that really fascinating, the lack of reticence. I mean, people's enormous willingness and urgent need to talk about this, and yet really only with anonymity assured. I mean,
well, that was the step we had to take. There are people whose careers, the people who feel certainly that their careers would be jeopardized by coming out publicly about this, and those are people whose careers absolutely depend on the accuracy of memory. Now, the fact that I had done that and my career absolutely depends on the accuracy of memory has now, since the book has been published, allowed a lot of other people to come out about it and talk about it. But at that time, when I was just doing the research, that wasn't the case. And certainly they needed anonymity. And at one point, I thought to myself, you know, maybe they really don't need anonymity. Maybe I can go back to all these people and say, hey, look, this is the group you're in. This is one heck of an esteemed group of people that I'm interviewing here, and maybe you can all go public. And believe me, the answers were not pretty. The answers were absolutely, definitely not. Are you out of your mind? And so we decided to stick with what I had always promised, which was anonymity.
Right. I thought it was interesting. You mentioned that for those in midlife who were starting to suffer from this, and I guess it does make sense, those who suffered the most from this would be those who had earlier in life always thought of themselves as having really strong cognitive abilities. I mean,
that's
they could
right.
just think of everything. They didn't need, you called it the mental ability to keep multiple plates spinning in the air. They didn't need calendars or meticulous notes. And then when that starts to change, I mean, it's a tremendous adjustment which they have to make, and I'm sure very unhappily so.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I saw it over and over again. I'm still seeing it. People are still writing to me. The fact is that people enter certain professions because they are equipped with certain types of skills. They don't develop the skills in the professions. People become lawyers, journalists, teachers. They enter professions where you have to stand and deliver, where that's what you do. You must be able to formulate your ideas and get them out of your mouth or out of your fingers, depending on what you're doing. And there's no time for thinking or fooling around too much, right? So I found that people who were in professions like that, and that would also include, by the way, psychologists and psychiatrists and actually a great many other people, stockbrokers fell into that category, people whose minds work very fast. I found that these people suffered the most, and they had never developed much in the way of what I refer to as scaffolding. They had never set up systems that would allow them to remember without relying exclusively on their brains to do it. And to some extent, I was one of those, not quite to the extent of some other people. I mean, I had a woman who's the head of marketing for a very large retail company tell me that, you know, she'd never used a calendar, and she was almost 50 at the time. She'd never used a calendar. Her assistant was decorative. I mean, she didn't really have a reason for having an assistant because she was able to hold everything in her head. And when 50 came for her and it all came to a crashing halt, she simply had no idea of how to rejigger herself. And only now, I mean, 4 years later, is she beginning to surface from that. It's been a long, hard pull.
Interesting. You also mentioned at one point that especially difficult are a lot of people who in midlife find, for maybe one reason or another, sometimes for just personal preference and sometimes out of real necessity, that they need to be shifting careers or going back to school or taking on new skills. Mm-hmm. And to face that prospect simultaneously with facing the reality of eroding cognitive skills, I mean,
it can be very, very challenging. I mean, it's part of, actually, I mean, it's a joyful thing, frankly. We have been given a gift, our demographic, and certainly those coming behind us have been given a wonderful gift, and that gift is really what you could say is a spare third of a life. You know, we've got years that are certainly our grandparents never expected to have and generally didn't have, and years that our parents didn't expect to have and now sometimes are not quite sure what to do with. But for us, we know, we think we're going to have these years. We have an expectation that, you know, 60 to 80 is going to be pretty great. And so there's a lot of expectations and hopes for what those years will be like. And very often people decide to have career changes in their late 40s, early 50s, all the way up and through their 60s. People are doing this. There's one woman that I interviewed who had been she's a molecular biologist working for a a big company for her entire career, 25 years, right through, you know, postdoc onward. And she'd always wanted to teach science at the high school level. So she got her teaching credential, and she went ahead and applied for jobs, and she got a job teaching science. Now, there was something a little odd about this job because she was to come in to replace a teacher who was gone off on maternity leave, and she was to teach three completely different sciences at the high school level. And, of course, although she knows molecular biology inside and out, she's not exactly too strong in astronomy. So she had to go and learn all this material so that she could teach it. And at last, last discussion, this was proving extremely difficult for her.
One thing that you do in the book that surprised me just a little bit, but I'm really glad you did it, is you really take some time to recount a lot of the different things that forgetful people forget. I mean, the different kinds of things that can happen, the different ways in which failing memory can sort of sabotage our daily lives professionally or personally and so on. I thought that was interesting. What do you think is the real value of that, is aside from maybe the most immediately obvious, which is just that it's kind of interesting and even sometimes entertaining to kind of read about that. But what does that substantively give us in understanding this?
I think a lot of people don't realize that different pieces of their lives are involved in forgetfulness. You know, people have said to me many times, you know, I'm not forgetful, I'm just disorganized. And I said, well, let's just break that down. What does that mean? What is organization? Let's talk about what organization is. Organization is essentially slotting things into places where you can remember where they are. That is what organization is. That's what the Container Store is making. I assume you have that where you are.
This great
behemoth. That's what they're making a fortune on, is making it so people can remember what they did with the family photos, making it so that they could find the tax returns. This is memory. This is what this is about. And so people who are terribly disorganized can't remember where they left anything. And that is, you know, that's part of the problem. In the book, I also talk about sort of something I think is barely recognized, which is the concept of negative space. I talk about how sometimes it's not that you forgot to take your wallet off your desk. It's something that you can't see. It's something that's invisible to you that you've forgotten. You've never written down that there's a birthday party on Friday and Saturday for one of your neighbor's kids. You're just holding that in your head, and there's no evidence of it anywhere, and it disappears into what I call negative space, and it's not retrievable because there are absolutely no cues to retrieve it. So those are things that are a little less commonly considered to be issues of forgetfulness. So they're the more obvious ones. There's, blanking on words. You're in the middle of a sentence and suddenly you cannot remember the word asparagus. I mean, that happens to people. Or blocking on people's names. This is it's so common in midlife that when scientists are putting together the protocols for their research studies, you know, and there's usually a questionnaire involved for, you know, clinical research where, you know, they want to assess where you're coming from. The fact that you blank on people's names doesn't even push you out of the study. You can still be in it. It's so common. It's so ordinary. But then there's something a little more complicated, which is not blanking on people's names, but blanking on people. In other words, somebody approaches you and you simply cannot identify who that person is, even though that person seems to know exactly who you are. And I went, I have quite an issue with this myself, although it seems to be getting better as everything else gets better. But even in the course of my book tour, where I was in five cities and very often people I hadn't seen in 20 or more years were walking towards me as I was signing books. And then I could recognize the people that I had known 20 years ago, by and large. We didn't have a single surprise there. But what was much more challenging for me were people that I had met more recently. Some of them I had to look really hard to be sure I knew. And at least one woman completely baffled me. And it was only about 4 days after I saw her that it occurred to me that who she was. It wasn't that I didn't know her name. It was I could not place her, and it took me a while to do so. So this is called prosopagnosia, and it is much more common than has been previously thought. It is often associated with some sort of mild traumatic brain injury.
I thought that was intriguing because this array of different kinds of memories and different kinds of forgetfulness, because it helps us realize that this can take so many forms. And sometimes memory lapses and difficulties, which can really have tragic consequences, and then others that are just sort of inconvenient, and some that are embarrassing, and sort of everything in between. But I think you characterize quite rightly that this is part of every facet of our lives, and that when our memory is affected, we are affected, like it or not, in such a comprehensive kind of way.
Yes.
And no wonder this is such a burning issue for people.
It's really true. And it is the only thing that I know of that really affects every part of our lives. You know, it's not something that you can say, well, it's only a problem at work. It's never only a problem at work. It is something that permeates every aspect of who we are.
Yeah.
Which, yes, I mean, most of the time it's somewhere between irritating and frustrating. And many times it can be comical, if you want to look at it that way, because you can get a bunch of people sitting around having what I refer to as the contentless conversation, where more information is missing than present. And you know, you just have to laugh. I mean, it to me, I go through my days now, you know, eavesdropping on people. Anytime the word memory is spoken or forget, you know, I'm just riveted, which makes it difficult to have lunch with me. But it's so common for people to say, you know, I read this great book, and I just finished it. I can't remember the name of it. You know, it's sort of like that other one. You know, the one where the guy lived near the mountain. I think that one was called Cold Mountain. Now, just give me a second, and let me see if I can remember what the name of this other one is that I just read. And I'm just sitting there cracking up. So that is, you know, that's funny. But it's not funny when a woman told me yesterday, she phoned me, and she told me that she was having a big problem. Problem was mostly between her daughter and her husband. Her daughter is 17, and her husband is 54. And apparently, they are fighting because her husband is forgetting absolutely everything that her daughter tells him. And she said, the daughter said to her mom, took her aside and said, Mom, you know, would you just tell me, is it the early stages of Alzheimer's for Dad? Because if it is, I want to stop fighting with him. You know, he's just making me so darned mad, and he's so defensive. But just tell me if he's really sick, then, you know, I'm going to change how I handle this. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, first of all, what a sensitive young woman, actually, because most 17-year-olds, and I am equipped with one myself, would not think of that, I don't think. But really, how heartrending that the father's forgetfulness is causing these kinds of problems in the home.
Wow. I think of the example of my my mother-in-law, who is no longer alive, and she had to contend with kind of a double blow of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that was really particularly difficult for her was, and in some ways this kind of signaled the sort of the beginning of the end, was when she took a fall and broke her hip and had to be hospitalized. And then...
Mm-hmm. And that
then,
would be so confused.
Right. And then went into kind of a rehabilitation home. And the rehabilitation did not go very well. And I think it was over time that we realized, first of all, she was certainly encumbered by the fact that she had Parkinson's disease. So that
yes.
certainly robbed her of some strength and coordination. But I think that a big part of it also was the fact that by that point in time, her short-term memory had been very, very seriously compromised. And
yes.
so for her, she had been robbed of any sense of momentum. I mean, someone with more normal memory would remember, well, yeah, you know, I did this today, and I did it yesterday, and it made me feel a little better, and I did it the day before that, and when I started, it was harder, but now it's a little easier. And, right. And I mean, all those different ways in which just being able to remember where you've just been, not geographically, but I mean on the arc of recovery.
Right.
And for her, every day, when she was confronted with, you know, this ring she had to pull herself up on, or whatever the task was.
It was all new.
It was all the first thing.
And I'm sure painful.
Yeah. And why am I doing this? And for her, my sense was that there was absolutely no momentum whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it never would have dawned on me until seeing her and her struggles. It would never have dawned on me that memory could play a role in that kind of way, kind of a secondhand player, just beneath the surface, just beyond the obvious, but really with some very important and sad consequences for her.
Right. Well, I'm sure there was some depression involved, which is also, of course, really common in Parkinson's disease. So the double whammy would do it. And one of the aspects of memory and depression that I find very fascinating is that when memory is impacted, it's hard to recover from depression, because one of the things that allows you to recover from depression is a ability to remember the good things that have just happened or that will happen. And when you're having trouble remembering much of anything, you don't have any, you can't make yourself have anything to look forward to, because you simply don't have the recollection of good times or the hope of them in the future. And I'm sure that's some of what she experienced.
Hmm. We're speaking with Catherine Jacobson-Raymond about her book, Carved in Sand. By the way, I'm afraid I'll forget if I don't ask you right now while it occurs to me, how you came up with that marvelous title.
Well, if you look in the book, there is a quote, and it is from Primo Levi, from The Drowned and the Saved. And shall I take a second to read it to you?
Yeah, and I see that, okay. Now. I missed that when I read the book.
Human memory is a marvelous but fallacious instrument. The memories which lie within us are not carved in stone. Not only do they tend to become erased as the years go by, but often they change or even increase by incorporating extraneous features. And I read that after having spent many, many hours trying to come up with a title. And if you could see the sheets of paper covered with my very bad ideas, and somewhere I read that quote and I said, you know what, that's it. It's, no, they're not carved in stone. They're carved in sand. But someone pointed out to me recently in an interview that there's more to the title than I knew. What is also carved in sand is how this will end for you. There are certain genetic predispositions towards what kind of cognitive abilities you'll have at the end of your life, but they are carved in sand. It is not. They're not carved in stone. They're not definite. You can change this, and that, even though the most of our conversation here has been about, you know, all the difficult things that happen with memory. The real point of my book and the thrust of it is that you, in midlife, this is the time you can change your future. And I don't think that most people are aware of that. I think people have always understood that they need to, you know, they need to work out, keep their bodies in shape, keep their hearts working and their lungs healthy, et cetera. But I think it's a relatively new idea that, in fact, you can have a major impact on your brain. And so a good deal of my book is actually dedicated to how do you do that. And I went out and did 10 interventions in the book where I see different scientists, different physicians. I take an 8-week meditation class. I do neurofeedback. I finally get my thyroid situation under control. I go to a sleep disorder center and discover some things about how important, how critically important sleep is to memory. There's a real wide array. But what I learn in the course of the book is this, you know, people say, ew, is it normal? Well, yeah, I guess so, in that it occurs in all mammals, you know, whether you're a chimp or a rat, and middle-aged mammals experience this. But That doesn't mean that it's acceptable, and it doesn't mean that you have to just sit down and take it. There are many ways that you can alter your cognitive future, and that's why when it was, in fact, a New Zealand radio station, the host said to me, carved in sand, well, that means that you can change what's happening, what's going to happen to your brain. And I said, wow, you're smart. I never thought of that. But now that you mention it, yes, there's two ways to take this.
Absolutely. It's interesting, as you talk about these various, I think at one point you call them interventions,
mm-hmm.
where we sort of intervene on behalf of ourselves and our memory and try to do something that's going to enhance the memory we have and maybe build back some of what is lost. These really do range far and wide. And it's interesting, I feel like you write very honestly and frankly, and yet do not presume to say, this one was fabulous, this one was worthless. Because such a pronouncement might really do a disservice
right.
to someone who might be helped by something that was not particularly helpful to you.
Yes, and it just really depends on what stage of life you're in. You know, one thing I always say is that I'm a journalist. I'm not a scientist. I'm certainly not an MD. And thus, you will not find me prescribing anything to anybody, ever. So all we can do is talk about what I did and how it worked for me. Now, one thing that seems to help many, many people with memory and attention is meditation. And I'm starting to believe that this, along with getting the proper kinds of nutrition and sufficient sleep, that this is a three-pronged where you start type of thing. And for me, meditation was, even though I didn't take an 8-week class and made a substantial commitment to it, not a very successful strategy because every time I sat down, I fell asleep. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that. One is that I definitely have issues with insomnia that are just now resolving. And the other is that I was working phenomenally long hours on this book. Now, that's not the case for everybody. Some people sleep fine and they work normal hours. And then, thus, meditation could be really a major part of the answer for them. And what I say in the book is that, you know, no scientist would ever set up multiple protocols to run at the same time. I mean, you would never dream of doing that. Your results are fouled by that. But I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist, and I wanted to get as much improvement as quickly as I could. And so I did run all of these, many of them simultaneously. So I would be meditating and attempting to meditate and also working on nutrition or trying certain cognitively enhancing drugs while attempting to resolve my sleep issues. So these are all things that happen in combination. And so I don't feel that it's appropriate to say, yeah, this works and this doesn't, because some of these will work for everybody, and people seem to have the inherent ability to recognize their own situations within this book. I'm finding from the response that people know which ones are them and which ones are not.
You talk of how you feel like you have really regained your mojo and that you have come to terms with some ways in which you need to live your life differently. And I like the parallel that you draw that for someone who wants to muscle through as best they can without changing anything, it's a little bit like somebody who's become nearsighted refusing to wear glasses.
Right.
I mean, it's foolish in the extreme, and especially, as we said earlier, when we're talking about something that is so pervasively important in every aspect of life as memory is.
Right. Well, you know, I say that the first step is to acknowledge that there is a problem. And boy, that sounds simple, doesn't it? But in fact, it can be very challenging because there are very powerful ramifications in acknowledging this about who you're going to be for the rest of your life. What's your aging trajectory going to be like? Are you going to be useful as an elder? Are you going to have a point, you know? So to acknowledge that there is a problem and then to get really down to it and say, okay, this is where the problem lies. Now, for me, every bloody time I park my car in a large parking structure or in a big parking lot, I would misplace it because this is just who I am. I am, you know, headlong after the next thing, parking the car is a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned at that particular moment. And so I find a space, jump out of the car, and fully intent on my mission, head for, you know, my interview or Macy's or whatever. And come back out, and then, well, I have to join all the other middle-aged people who are looking for their cars in the parking lot. And I said to myself one day, you know what? Acknowledge the problem, for heaven's sake. Say to yourself, you know what? Every time you get out of the car, you lose it, and then you spend 15 very frustrating minutes in, you know, in rain and high wind looking for it. So could you just get over it here? And you know, I have to talk to myself like that. And I said, well, yes, I could. I could get out of the car, and every time I could look around and say, well, I'm in purple, which is B4, and I know this. And also now, as I walk to the elevator, I'm going to observe that I'm turning right, which means that when I come out of that elevator, I'm going to be turning left. And, you know, where approximately is this vehicle located? And it's a simple intervention. It takes all of, you know, 15 seconds. And yet it saves me time and anguish and, frankly, feeling like an idiot when you can't find your car. So that is one way that we can intervene on that. It's very straightforward. But once you do acknowledge it, and you say, you know, boy, do I have trouble with names. I was just at a school event, and four people came up to me, and damned if I could introduce any of them to any of the other ones, because I'm really bad with names. Well, maybe that's not important to you, but perhaps one of those people held the key to your next major business deal, and then maybe it is important to you. One of the scientists I interviewed, Daniel Schachter, who's a psychologist at Harvard and a very esteemed author himself, said to me before he goes to a school event, he gets out the directory out of the kitchen drawer, and he sits down with it for 10 minutes and just reviews the names of people. And he says very often that is so helpful to him because, you know, he's well known. People know who he is, and there's an expectation that he will perhaps step up to the plate and know who they are. And there's a certain concern about either being arrogant or self-absorbed about not knowing who people are when you've met them time after time. I don't think anyone gets worked up if you've just met somebody once and you can't produce the name. I think that's pretty ordinary. But time after time after time, it can have its side effects.
It's not fun.
No.
You know, as I read your book, and particularly the experience of these various interventions and the improvement which one can experience, couldn't help but think back to a recent well-known story, that of ABC journalist Bob Woodruff,
yes.
So seriously interviewed in Iraq, and
yes.
I was honored to interview his wife, Lee, briefly. But I remember in watching a documentary and then reading about it in the book, too, how he's, of course, worked very hard to rebuild what was lost in that accident, and you see scenes where he's looking at pictures of things like an apple, a
right.
dog,
right.
a lollipop, and trying to come up with those words. And of course, his situation, I mean, at the beginning, it was hard to know if this will be a continuous improvement or is this going to stop at some point. But it became clear the more he worked and the longer he worked, the better this became. And what a nice picture that is versus the other of giving in to this and accepting the fact that, well, I have ahead of me a steady and irreversible decline
right.
in my powers. I mean, two very different ways to look to the future.
Well, certainly he has done an extraordinary job. I am just bowled over and impressed. I mean, this man was in a coma for weeks, and this is, you know, not, I don't think, necessarily generally known, but he was in a coma. I mean, there was no expectation for him. And he has just done a remarkable, remarkable job. You know, whether he, in fact, will ever be able to do the job that he's done previously, I sort of doubt it. You know, I don't think it necessarily goes that far. But the fact that he can get up in front of people and speak, it's extraordinary. But what it speaks to mostly, primarily, is the notion, which is a fairly recent idea, of brain plasticity. And the fact that we are equipped with neurons and synaptic connections that can be repurposed to do the jobs of ones that are not working well or not working at all anymore. And one of the things that's really required to maintain cognitive strength throughout the lifespan is this notion of challenge, mental challenge. And people don't quite get what that is. I mean, when I started asking people what did they do for mental challenge, I got this laundry list of our daily lives, you know, starting with getting up at 5:30 a.m. to, you know, finish up some work, get breakfast ready, put in a load of laundry, you know, take a shower, get the kids up. I mean, it was that kind of list that we, you know, any of us who are two-career families, we can all provide that list. But what was missing was this unique notion that you really need to do something that is completely different for you in order to build this brain plasticity, in order to allow it to take place. And people said to me, you know, I'm not going to have a mental challenge. I'm just way too exhausted. And I said, well, you know what? Frankly, so am I. But that's no excuse. We really do need to find a way to challenge our brains to do something out of the ordinary. And what you've been doing in your career is really not going to do it for most people unless, you know, there's some drastic difference in what you're doing. And that's unusual at this stage of life. So what do you do? Well, you know, people said, well, what do I have to do, calculus? And I said, well, luckily no, because I can barely help my seventh grader with his math homework. But you can start playing chess. You can play Scrabble. You can play bridge. People took up competitive pool, which is highly strategic. And anything that's strategic is very, very useful. Very interesting. We have people doing Tai Chi, which requires, first of all, makes substantial demands on memory in order to remember the order of the movements, and also calls into play many critical motor skills. And motor skills should not be ignored here, because these also have a major impact on the brain, you know, using these motor skills. I took up salsa dancing, which I love, and I am quite uncoordinated, so this is a challenge for me. It wouldn't be for everyone. I mean, if you've been a dancer all your life, I don't think this is going to do it. But for me, what I move mostly are my fingers on the keyboard. So for me, this was a really big challenge. I'd have to learn the steps. I have to pay attention to what my partner was doing and operate in the space of the dance floor so as not to crash into everyone and listen to the music and stay with the beat. And then there's also this very important element of social interaction. This should not be ignored. And I think that it really isn't getting as much attention as it ultimately will. One of the most important things we can do for the brain is to put it in front of other brains. Our face-to-face communication is what our brain is set up to do. This is how, from an evolutionary adaptive perspective, this is how we were built. We were not built with microprocessors. We were built with brains that come to life, that show under MRI all sorts of electrical activity when they are in the presence of another human being. And the fact that we are less and less in the presence of other human beings is a problem. It's a problem for the brain. And it's easy now that many people work at home and they work out of, you know, home offices, they work alone, they don't often see other people, for this whole faculty to go unused. And I think it's something we really have to guard against. Particularly as people get older, the amount of social isolation is just phenomenal. It's really frightening to me that this may be the number one thing, besides certain health issues, that takes people down the road to dementia. It is very difficult for an older person with physical handicaps to get out and be in front of other people.
And that contact can make a huge difference.
Huge. So next time you decide you're going to communicate with your friends by email, instead make a date to have coffee.
That and much more great advice in this marvelous book called Carved in Sand, When Attention Fails and Memory Fades in Midlife. It's published by HarperCollins, and its author, Catherine Jacobson Raymond. I thank you so much for writing this potentially a life-saving book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, which recently lowered tuition by 30% and guarantees graduation in 4 years.